From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week marked the opening salvo in a war over the budget likely to dominate the agenda of politicians and pundits for months, if not years.
The leaders of a bipartisan commission appointed by the president offer a far-reaching and controversial plan.
They go after fundamental tax reform, which would raise revenues but also make the tax code much better, and they basically spread the cost of this plan across the entire budget.
First off, this wasn't a report from the president's bipartisan fiscal panel. That needs 14 of its 18 members to agree, and they don't. This is just a draft opened up for debate by its co-chairs, Republican Alan Simpson and Democrat Erskine Bowles. So the headlines, like those in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal referring to the panel, are wrong. The panel ain't talking. Meanwhile, a Christian Science Monitor headline read, quote, "A bipartisan and reality-based way to cut taxes and reduce the deficit. Really? If only. After all, according to Congressman Eric Cantor, our government has spent more money in the past 2 years than in the previous 200 combined. Actually, that's not true at all. In fact, much of what politicians have said about our deficit and national debt is decidedly not reality-based. PolitiFact.com reporter and researcher Angie Drobnik-Holland has found no shortage of half-truths and flat-out falsehoods. Angie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, start with that statement by Eric Cantor, the Republican from Virginia. Here he is on The Daily Show in October.
What you've seen is a crowd that has taken advantage of a crisis back in late 08, early 09, and spent more money than this country has spent in the last 200 years combined in the 2 years since.
Just how false is that statement? Could you break it down?
Well, we gave that statement our worst rating, which is pants on fire. We went to the historical tables that the government produces on debt and started adding up the years. We found the debt was quite significant for 2009 and 2010, about $7.2 trillion. But then we started adding up the years before that, and when we added up 2008, 2007, and 2006, we had already exceeded the number of those past 2 years. So there is just no way that this statement was correct, and we gave it our worst rating of pants on fire.
No resemblance to reality at all.
No, the debt situation is significant, but it's not that bad.
Another Virginia congressman, Democrat Bobby Scott, said in a written statement, quote, "If all of the Bush-era tax cuts expire on schedule, the budget will be close to being balanced in 4 years." That sounds almost unbelievable.
We rated that one false. And the reason it's false is if you let all of the Bush tax cuts expire, you do reduce the deficit very significantly, but it's still not balanced. You basically get it back to what's considered more reasonable levels of debt.
What about this four-year time span?
No, it's not correct. If you get rid of all the Bush-era tax cuts, you still have deficits pretty much as far as the eye can see. Now, again, much smaller, but no, it still wouldn't be balanced.
On election night, Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan, who will be the chairman of the House Budget Committee, he made an interesting assertion.
The spending bills that you've signed into law, the domestic discretionary spending has been increased by 84%.
We rated this one barely true. What we found was that there was a spike between 2008 and 2010, the past 2 years. That spike in 2009 was because of the stimulus. Now, to get to that 84% increase, Paul Ryan counts the stimulus. But if you look at the 2010 discretionary spending, it's only about 24% over 2008. That's why we rated it barely true.
Mm-hmm.
The stimulus was a one-time injection. It does not keep increasing the budget as the years go forward.
Let me ask you about one more. This one was written in an op-ed by former U.S. Senator George Allen. He claimed that the national debt is currently $6 trillion more than when Obama was sworn into office.
It's actually only about $3 trillion right now. What's interesting is that if Obama serves his whole term, then it would reach $6 trillion, but not right now. So we rated this one false.
Is there one that I've left out that you consider to be a red-hot whopper?
You know, one thing that we hear regularly are kind of statements that if you eliminated all the foreign aid, you could fix the deficit. if you got rid of the waste, fraud, and abuse, you could fix the deficit. Well, the deficit is actually too significant for that sort of thing. Foreign aid is a relatively small percentage of the budget. Earmarks are less than 2%. To really get the budget under control, you need to look at three of the biggest spending categories: defense, Medicare, and Social Security. The people who really study this and who are nonpartisan and aren't running for office say that we really need spending cuts and tax increases, that the scale is just too large to do it without both.
You write about budget and deficit-related issues quite a lot. Is it, do you think, that the math and the numbers tend to trip people up, or are we talking willful deception in a number of cases?
I think that the federal budget is very complicated, and it's easy to get things wrong.
I can't believe you're not willing to concede that some of these people are just lying.
You know, Pants on Fire is our worst rating, and it kind of speaks for itself.
Angie, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Angie Dropnick-Holin is a reporter and researcher for PolitiFact.
Out of control federal spending was the theme relentlessly hammered by GOP candidates leading up to the midterm elections. Tea Partiers in particular raged about bailouts, earmarks, and general government profligacy, and the message resonated. But then, as if on cue, this week the chairman of the president's bipartisan panel on deficit reduction issued a draft proposal that made it all too clear that discretionary spending, where all the anger was focused, is not where the trouble lies. The real cuts must center on military and entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, and so on, which few politicians ever will have the will to cut. To University of California linguist Jeffrey Nunberg, the indignation so ubiquitous in sound bites is, and always will be, incompatible with the real problem.
You have this wonderful rhetoric of waste, fraud, and abuse, or waste, fraud, and inefficiency, or waste, fraud, and dishonor. I mean, it's had all these forms since the 19th century, which suggests that you really can just cut the fat, as people like to say.
They're talking about cutting the fat. Meantime, there's a giant carcass called entitlement programs in a meat locker that, until now, nobody's talked about trimming at all. As a linguist, how would you focus attention on that carcass?
Well, I don't think there's any way to make that palatable or to sell that symbolically to people. When you say to someone, you're going to have to work another 3 years before you take Social Security, or you're going to lose your mortgage deduction, nobody's going to be able to accept that, and there's no buzz phrase that's going to make it more palatable to the voter.
But at the same time, Alan Simpson, the Republican co-chair, found a metaphor. He talked about the difference between minnows, and I guess he means waste, fraud, and corruption, as opposed to the whales that are the fat part of the budget. What about whales? You like whales?
Whales is great, but if you say to people that waste, fraud, and corruption are minnows, it's going to sound as if you're slighting them or making them less important than they are. And people will come back with all these horror stories. And it doesn't matter if it only involves $31,000 from a project in Kansas or $212,000 that went to what looks like a silly research project. The horror and the delight that people take in recounting these is the same as if you're talking about $3 billion.
William Proxmire, a Democrat, made a career out of identifying what at first glance looked like silly, wasteful domestic programs because people were so quick to get angry about them. So why is it so hard to imagine a politician making political hay, and I'm going to mix some metaphors here in front of a linguist, and I apologize for that, make hay targeting whales and not minnows?
I don't think very many politicians who are serving now and who want to be reelected are going to see any incentive, any interest in telling people Social Security checks are going to be cut, your medical benefits are going to be cut. It's not going to happen. What has happened that's interesting is that retired politicians and people who are, so to speak, out of it can say these things. And that may help. But politicians who do vote for these things, whether they're on the left or the right, depending on the cuts involved, are going to find themselves attacked for it the next time they run for office.
You know, I saw in an Ezra Klein blog post in the Washington Post, he referred to what is in effect an itemized tax bill for a hypothetical taxpayer paying $5,400 in federal income tax and FICA combined. And it breaks it down so that you can see you pay $1,040 in Social Security, $625 in Medicare, $385 in Medicaid, military is about $1,000 bucks. And then you get down to things like Amtrak, $2.23.
Right.
Foreign aid is, you know, $20 or something like that. Funding for the arts, 24 cents. It does a nice job of putting things in perspective. What do you think about the itemized bill thing? Should politicians be sending it to us?
That might help, but my sense is that if you cast those percentages out as raw numbers, people are still going to be shocked and indignant because it's enjoyable. No matter that an expense of $1,200,000 or $54,000 for this or that boondoggle means very little, almost is trivial against the federal budget. $54,000 to the average person is a humongous amount of money. And the indignation's exactly the same as if you were talking about $5 billion wasted on no-bid contracts for Blackwater.
Let me see if I understand this right. Are you saying that language has the power to amplify human psychology, but not to defeat it?
In a way, that's right. Walter Lippmann talked about the need in a democratic society where the facts, as he said, exceed our curiosity to resort to symbolic activity. Symbols, he said, are things that assemble emotions after they've been detached from ideas. And I think it's at the level of symbolic activity that these phrases really operate most efficiently. A phrase like trim the fat has a symbolic resonance that some more accurate and precise description might not, just because people don't really want to know. As Lippmann said, the facts exceed our curiosity.
Well, Jeff, as always, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, so how do you get the entire internet skivvies in a wad? Thing is, it's impossible to predict.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, looking to transform health and healthcare through its Pioneer portfolio at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For several years now, dozens of parties, including the U.S., Japan, and members of the European Union, have been negotiating what's called the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA. It's a kind of treaty involving copyright and intellectual property rights, only it's been hammered out largely behind closed doors and subject to virtually no public input. Earlier this year, an official draft of the treaty was finally released, allowing legal scholars to see what our trade reps have been up to. And many are not happy. Harvard Law School's Jonathan Zittrain and about 70 other law professors from around the country have written an open letter to President Obama, raising a number of concerns and objections. For starters, says Zittrain, the Obama administration's plans to treat ACTA not as a treaty but as a, quote, executive agreement, requiring only a signature from the president.
Which is very different from a formal treaty, where the president signs on the dotted line and then submits it to the United States Senate for ratification. And an executive agreement of this sort isn't allowed to be inconsistent with the law of the United States.
Now, the U.S. trade rep has said, oh, no problem, this will not be in conflict with any existing U.S. laws. But can we take his word for that?
The thing here is that this agreement has gone through several drafts, and there are at least earlier drafts that we only know of because they were leaked that seem to be baldly in conflict with U.S. law. The most recent draft has been a little bit watered down, and this draft is the one that has finally been officially released for people to take a look at. And so there may be ways to try to delicately steer it in between, and that can hinge on just the addition or subtraction of one or two words.
Now, you mentioned that some of the provisions are baldly in conflict with existing law. Give me a for instance.
Internet service providers could actually become liable for copyright infringement that is said to have been done by their users. And that's something for which, in a hard-fought law passed in 1998, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, there were actually very careful provisions that said, so long as ISPs do the following kinds of actions, we guarantee they can't be held responsible for any infringement that happened up to the time that they found out about it. And at least earlier drafts of the agreement seemed to contravene that. More recently, I'm not as sure that that's the case. These are really complicated things. And this agreement, when finally shared officially rather than leaked, was shared at a point where the trade rep's office said, there will be no public comment. That time has passed, and this is the horse we're riding into town.
This is all kind of jaw-dropping because it seems to me that one of the things that the Obama administration got into office complaining about was the exertion of excessive executive authority. How does it justify the way it's gone about negotiating ACTA and kind of forcing it on the American people?
You have a trade rep that's wanting to push for an agreement that benefits the parties that say they are most affected. And of course, the most focused parties in this may well be the traditional mainstream content industries. And they indeed have been consulted and a part of this process. So when we say secret, it's not as if it's classified. There have been outsiders to the government who have been welcomed into the process. And it's not clear to me that they don't have a role there. It's just it's been uneven. There are a number of what you might call public interest groups, Public Knowledge, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, just within the U.S. alone, that have a lot of expertise, and you bet they have a view on what certain restrictions would do for the average internet user or for somebody who's wanting to share stuff on a peer-to-peer network but not infringe copyright or something that might involve copyrighted material but count as a fair use and therefore be protected by law. These are the sorts of interests that I think were excluded because they're not really on the Rolodex. And of course, part of it may be too that if they should be included, these are the types of stakeholders who, when they have a problem with something, they tend to shout it from a mountaintop. They really try to gather petitions and get the public involved. But you can see sociologically, if your job is to somehow get this treaty rocking and rolling, that you might have the people that you think are going to shout at you kept as far at bay as possible until it's a done deal. And I think that's basically what happened here.
Well, it sounds eerily reminiscent of Vice President Cheney's energy policy deliberations, which included energy companies, oil companies, and so forth, and excluded environmentalists, for example. Is this the Obama administration version of Cheney's energy task force?
But at least with the Cheney example, the administration's defense of it at the time was, look, here's the vice president. He's heading up some ideas within the administration for various things that would, you know, make America better for energy. And these are the people he chose to consult with. You know, that's it. Take it or leave it. There are lots of problems with that, but that was as far as it went. In this case, what we have is the United States as a party to an agreement that is multilateral. It's among lots of different governments around the world. And here, as best we can tell, and again, this is sort of done by leaks, the United States was among those states pushing for the hardest line on intellectual property. When you look at earlier drafts of this ACTA agreement, there really are some things in it that just fly in the face completely of what Congress had already intended. And it's not as if Congress is, you know, totally fair use and internet user friendly. They have their own constituents that they respond to as well. So I would differentiate it a bit from Cheney in a way that might make it a little worse from a transparency point of view, because this is the U.S. government advocating as the United States and pushing back and forth with other countries without consulting as broadly as it should among its own constituencies.
So it's been a couple of weeks since you and your 70 colleagues signed this open letter. Have you heard from the White House?
To my knowledge, you know, we've had representatives going down to the mailbox every day when the postman comes, and it's empty so far. And of course, in the parlance of official letters back and forth, these things can take months without it being anything personal. And of course, the problem is that they might see the agreement signed and be a done deal before we get a letter back thanking us for our concern. And here's a signed autograph. And by the way, I've referred this to the trade rep. And, you know, please call the following 800 number. I guess I figure that the letter's purpose in some way is effectuated as public pressure. It may well have an influence on whether this thing ultimately gets signed.
Well, Jonathan, as always, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Zittrain is a professor at Harvard Law School. Speaking of copyright, on November 3rd, writer and blogger Monica Gaudio posted a story on her LiveJournal about how a small Massachusetts magazine called Cook's Source had published without her permission an article she had written about apple pie. Gaudio said she then asked Cook's source editor, Judith Griggs, to print an apology and to donate $130 to the Columbia School of Journalism. Instead, she got a response which read, in part,
"But honestly, Monica, the web is considered public domain, and you should be happy we didn't just lift your whole article and put someone else's name on it." She added, "If you took offense and are unhappy, I am sorry, but you as a professional should know that the article we used, written by you, was in very bad need of editing and is much better now than was originally." She concluded, "You should compensate me."
The backlash on the internet was swift and severe. Netizens scoured old issues of Cook's source and found more articles and photographs seemingly plagiarized from the Food Network and Martha Stewart. Cook's source Facebook page was overrun with users mocking Griggs, some of whom posted her phone number and address. Her advertisers were called about her ethical indiscretion. Her letter spawned a meme with the phrase, "But honestly, Monica," and the verb "to Griggs" was coined, meaning to use content on the web without permission, then request payment from the original author for rewrites and editing.
On Tuesday, Cook's source issued an apology saying that it had made the requested donation to the Columbia Journalism School, as well as an additional donation to the Western New England Food Bank in Gaudio's name. The magazine also pledged to be more careful in vetting submitted articles and assigning credit going forward. Too little, too late. Griggs had enraged the internet. But how much of that was due to righteous indignation, and how much to a kind of online mob mentality that ignites on a dime? Last year, we spoke to writer Mattathias Schwartz about the website 4chan, whose users frequently engage in this kind of internet blitzkrieg.
They do it for fun. They do it for a sense of release. And they do it because when you're looking at someone across a screen hundreds of miles away, you don't have to empathize with them at all.
Schwartz considered them to be mostly harmless, saying, quote, "It's important to keep in mind that it's impossible to hurt a person through a computer." Yet some cases of internet vigilantism have had real-world consequences. Most recently, in October, a British woman named Mary Bale was fined £250 and banned from keeping pets for 5 years after a video of her tossing a cat into a garbage can taken from a closed-circuit camera was posted online, outraging users on 4chan.
Hey, maybe they all had it coming. The point is, the internet allows people to unite across limitless distance, and people power can cut both ways. As NYU professor and social media expert Clay Shirky observed,
"The things we're unleashing into society by having this kind of new group capability are not entirely positive, right? This is not a cyber utopian story. This is actually a revolution, and it's not a revolution if nobody loses.
So you better keep your head down."
Or someone on YouTube may wind up singing your email.
"But honestly, Monica, interwebs are public domain. And if you took offense and are unhappy, sorry."
For anyone thrilled at the wide open freedom of the internet, the inevitable question is, how long can it last? Tim Wu, a professor at Columbia University Law School, looks to history for the answer, and the answer is not very long unless we actively intervene. He sees a cycle in the evolution of all the other great information technologies of the last 150 years, the telegraph, the movies, radio. They start out wild and woolly until they are tamed and caged by men who would be emperors. Their empires, monopolies like AT&T and the early TV networks, wielded extraordinary power over the delivery and often the content of the information all of us received. A power described by a CBS executive in the 1950s as, quote, "the exclusive custody of the master switch." In his book called The Master Switch, Tim Wu describes the cycle that transforms a technological revolution into a monopoly. Consider the telephone. What started as a promising but buggy invention by Alexander Graham Bell turned into a juggernaut in the hands of empire builder Theodore Vail.
When Vail came to AT&T in 1907, it was a company that had less than half of the market share for telephones. There were hundreds, maybe thousands of competitors. It was a vibrant, open market. And what Vail did was to unify it all into a single consolidated monopoly.
Now, as we pursue this cycle, AT&T consolidated its power. It was very efficient in delivering service, but as you note, it only encouraged innovation and invention that bolstered its monopoly, and it crushed those innovations that didn't.
There's a repeat pattern we see with America's information monopolists. A new invention is created by a disruptive inventor, and it goes through a period of openness, entrepreneurial activity, a kind of a boom, and eventually, and typically, some great strongman arises who integrates the entire industry into a lasting monopoly. This repeats itself for the radio industry, the early telephone industry, the film industry, and today it may be repeating itself in the internet industry.
So how does the cycle end?
Well, once a monopoly is established, it itself is broken up by a new invention. So the telegraph empire was destroyed by the telephone. Or, occasionally, the government steps in and breaks it up. The AT&T breakup and the breakup of the Hollywood studios are the two main examples.
So then are they left in pieces or are they reassembled?
Sometimes someone new can arise and put the pieces back together. AT&T did that in 2006, reassembled itself. Sometimes something new arises and builds a new empire.
And you say that American culture in general seems to acknowledge that political power needs to be curbed. But there's a resistance to the notion that economic power needs to be curbed.
Yeah, we do have a big, powerful federal government, but we are constantly asking whether it needs to be less powerful, rolled back, what its limits are. In contrast, the American attitude towards private power, while it has its moments, is much more forgiving. We allow when we have a massive economic crisis like we just had, we say, well, that's just kind of the way it works, instead of doubting our fundamental approach to these things.
And you suggest that these times and this new technology calls for something you call the separations principle.
We need a sensitivity towards over-consolidation between the people who move information and the people who create it. The point is that when you have an over-consolidation of transport and content, you can have an influence over politics. You can end up with private censorship. You can end up with suppression of new innovation. And I think we need a principle like separation of church and state, where we say, you know, these are nice institutions, but they need to retain some distance. If, for example, Verizon and Google get too close together, if AT&T and Facebook want to become a single company, there are dangers from that.
What would the dangers be?
What would the dangers be? So Google and AT&T merging would result in a world in which it would be almost impossible to displace Google as a nation's dominant search engine. It could insulate itself against competition even after it had become antiquated or lost its edge. And it could also begin to favor certain companies over others on its search and would have a power over what Americans hear that would be close to unprecedented in American life.
Okay, so you suggest that the separations principle requires three active sets of participants. First, the federal government, then the entertainment, information, and technology companies,
right,
and then us.
The federal government has to provide some oversight of this, but most important of all, I think it is essential that it is a norm, that we see this as something that is dangerous, that we understand that in history this has produced problems. Because we're used to on the internet the idea you can reach anything you want. That is a separations principle in action. Over the summer when the news linked that Google and Verizon had done a secret deal, there was a lot of outrage. And I think that that shows that the public is sensitive to these sorts of issues.
You are widely regarded as the inventor of the phrase net neutrality. The principle of net neutrality is that an internet service provider like AT&T can't cut special deals for faster speeds for larger internet services like Google that are willing to pay more for them. Everybody gets to ride along the information highway at the same speed. This idea doesn't have a lot of support in Congress.
Net neutrality is, I would suggest, the governing principle on the internet today. Net neutrality is first and foremost a norm. And often a norm is more important than a law. It is not irrelevant what Congress thinks, but it's close to irrelevant. And the reason is that were, for example, AT&T to block Google tomorrow, it would not be tolerated. And so the net neutrality principle and its acceptance in the internet space is a prototype of a broader separations principle.
What's at stake if we don't adopt it?
Americans have contradictory impulses in this area. On the one hand, we love convenience and reliability, and that's what takes us to these monopolists over history. But our instinct towards convenience is tempered by another instinct which wants choice and freedom. And I'm suggesting that if Americans don't pay attention, it won't be obvious at first, but over time we will see that the content we receive is increasingly winnowed, filtered, chosen for us. And I think that while some of us may like that, that the better half of our tradition believes in access to a freer amount of speech.
Don't you think that even if there is somebody controlling the master switch, we'll still have a lot more speech with the advent of the internet than we ever have had in any era before?
It depends on whether we continue to live in a media environment where everyone can be a creator. There is an effort to return to an age where we mostly listen to simply the professionals and we get rid of all the amateurs. You know, it sounds unlikely now. I agree right now we're in an extremely open phase and I love it, but I'm suggesting that there is a taste also for fewer channels and that we could move back to something like the 1950s or 60s where there were very few channels for information.
Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tim Wu teaches at Columbia Law School. His book is called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires.
Coming up, 40 Years of Doonesbury, a talk with Gary Trudeau.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Doonesbury, the comic strip, is 40 years old. Big deal. Dennis the Menace is nearly 60, Blondie is 80, the Cats and Jammer kids are 113. So what makes Doonesbury so special? Well, for one thing, the characters age. They don't go through their paces in a frozen world. They live in a world in flux, and they reflect the evolving concerns, the battered sensibilities of baby boomers and their children. Doonesbury's 40th anniversary is being marked with the publication of two huge books, one by cartoonist Brian Walker and the other compiled by the author of the comic strip himself, Gary Trudeau. It's called 40, a Doonesbury retrospective, and it takes its readers on a journey of its characters' lives from their inception in a campus newspaper at Yale in 1970 to the ever-changing now. It's syndicated in some 1,400 newspapers, but it's unlikely to be passed down to other artists like the other strips I mentioned. If Doonesbury is to remain true to itself, it can only be created by Gary Trudeau, and it will have to end when he does. Gary Trudeau, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you so much. What a sad thought.
It will never end, and neither will you.
Well, I don't think it'll be a legacy strip. I mean, some of those strips that have gone on through four or five artists, and actually the second and third artists sometimes improve the strip, but I think mine will go with me.
Legend has it that the name Doonesbury stems from the word dune, a kind of slang for well-meaning fool, and the surname of your college roommate at Yale, Charles Pillsbury. In fact, a lot of Doonesbury's characters are based on people you knew there, or Walden College, as you sort of renamed it. Do all of your characters have roots embedded in reality?
Generally speaking, the characters start with an inspiration, with a person that I may have in mind, or some combination of people I may have known. Whatever it was that drew me to them in the first place often doesn't necessarily make for a good story. So, I mean, they're admirable people, and I almost routinely turn them into totally reprehensible people. This is the great compliment I pay the people I love. But even when it's a direct parody, as the Duke character was of Hunter Thompson, it's only a starting point. Initially, he was, for all intents and purposes, the character that Hunter Thompson had created in Fear and Loathing books.
Wild, renegade, hard-drinking, gonzo journalist. And Hunter Thompson apparently wasn't so crazy about the character of Duke.
So I've heard. I've never actually met him, but I think he found it copyright infringement. I don't think he quite got the concept of parody. I think he created this character of himself, and he felt he shouldn't even be commented on, that it was owned and operated by Hunter S. Thompson.
Is it fair to say that Doonesbury was really developed around three foundational characters? Mike Doonesbury, the everyman, and BD, the football quarterback, and the campus radical Mark Slackmire?
That was the original architecture of the strip. My editor said, you need to hit those different points on the political spectrum. And so it was this three-legged stool that we originally set up. Over time, the cast just grew and grew. I kept adding to it. And it's kind of a sprawling group now. There's over 70 characters. And it's demanding for longtime readers, and it's really unfair for new readers because it's like opening Tolstoy in the middle.
How have the events in your own life informed the lives of the characters in Doonesbury?
Well, I think that's unavoidable, but through most of my life, had a pretty bright line between my work life and my home life. I have colleagues who do family strips who, you know, take notes at home. I never did. There are bits and pieces, obviously, that make their way into the strip, but it's never conscious. When I go to work, I start with the subject, and then I cast it, and then I do the individual strips, often out of order.
So you'd come up with an idea, and then you cast the story from your selection of characters in order to bring out the point you're making?
Right. And there's some sense of trying to keep certain narrative arcs in rotation. There's a half a dozen storylines that are now active.
I think that anybody who was reading the strip at its inception would not have expected what you've done with BD, that character, the one who represented more the right leg of the political and cultural spectrum in that three-legged stool that you mentioned, would become such a sharp focus.
Well, that again was the subject driving the choice of character. Doonesbury was originally a sports strip. It was a parody of the exploits of a remarkable young athlete named Brian Dowling, who's the quarterback of my college football team and rather charismatic and as an individual was very self-effacing and modest and everything that BD, the character that was a parody of him, was not.
And so there he is, a fairly shallow guy. And as he moves through his life, he always wears a helmet. He switches football teams. He becomes a National Guardsman, a highway patrolman, then a soldier.
And finally, he loses his helmet as a result of the wound that he receives on the battlefield in Fallujah. And in the same panel, the reveal shows that he's missing a leg as well. And for many readers, both events were equally moving because losing the helmet signified that everything was different for BD, that his life was going to change dramatically. And it represented a commitment to a storyline that was much longer than any I've ever accepted in the past for myself. The whole point of it was to show what kinds of sacrifices our countrymen were making in our name over in Iraq at that time.
Let's talk about how you did that and why you did that, because here is where your real life and the lives of your characters, if they don't merge, they really richly inform each other. You've done a lot of traveling to the war zones. You've also spent a lot of time at Walter Reed Army Hospital.
The day that BD was wounded, the DOD got in touch and said, we see what you're doing. We see where you're going with this. And the subtext I've always thought was, it might be better if you got it right. So they invited me to Walter Reed and subsequently made my way downstream to the vet centers and tried to show what that journey is like for somebody who's wounded and who also has invisible wounds. That was not my original intention. I didn't mean to give BD PTSD. I was just concerned with the physical wound. But that was another journey he was on. And then he meets another character who comes into the vet center, the female character who's suffering from something called MST, military sexual trauma. See, that was my entry point in discussing a terrible subject called command rape. And this was Melissa's story.
But I mean, this is basically what makes Doonesbury so unusual. It is reportage. It's political commitment with narrative. So how did you decide what kind of artist you would be? And was there anyone outside who helped you make that decision?
Well, I had a professor when I was in college, and I came into it feeling that this was a course I was going to ace. You know, in my teenage years, I'd been the art jock. I was the art nerd. And so I was pretty happy with the drawings I was doing in that class. And yet they were sort of the visual equivalent of Muzak. You know, they were sort of charcoal stylings. And they were very facile. And one day the professor came over and he looked at my drawing and he ripped it off my drawing board and proceeded to tear it into pieces in front of the rest of the class. And he looked at me and said, yes, I know you can draw. What I'd really like to know is whether you can see. And so that was a very early lesson in paying attention. And what I've tried to be through my career is a good noticer and a good listener. And I have to listen to it. I have to pick up the music of it. I have to pick up the sense of different situations and characters. It's not something that I do when I'm not deliberately doing it. The rest of the time, I just go on and live my life like anyone else. I have artist friends who are not like that at all, that you take their art away from them, and it's like removing oxygen from the room. They just, you know, wither up. They can't handle the absence of stimulation that art provides them. I'm not quite like that. I need time away from it.
Which you took in abundance in the 80s.
I took 20 months off to work in the theater, yeah, which was my first great passion. And
really? The theater? Why not just run off to the circus?
Well, I did a Broadway show, and then I did an off-Broadway show, which continued on various versions of it after I came back. So I was able to indulge those early interests. I mean, I went out to Kansas City at the conclusion of my first contract, which was 12 years, and everyone was upset with me. And they said, this has never been done before. You can't take a sabbatical from a comic strip. Comic strips are public utilities. They go, you know, 365. There's no stopping. And I said, well, you know, I've been lucky, and I've been fortunate enough to have this success. What's the point if I can't leverage it to do some other things that I'm interested in?
You are saying that you have these friends who, without the art, it's like the oxygen has been sucked out of the room, and that's not how you are. A lot of writers that I know say that sometimes their characters just take over, and they have to sit back and let them. You've said, no, you cast your scripts with the characters. I just wonder if you ever let them off the leash.
I'm not sure what that means. I mean, I feel like I'm dragging them into it every day. I don't feel like they're pulling me along. I mean, yes, there are times where, as you're writing, the character seems to reveal himself or herself in certain ways. You go, oh, that's a really interesting direction to take them. And because I'm always on a very, very tight deadline, I have a weekly deadline on the strip, I will get ideas sometimes that are quite far ahead of where I actually was with the character. But there's no time to discard a good idea. So I'll write that strip, and then I'll have to reverse engineer it to get there.
You ran into a terrible deadline problem during the Nixon administration.
Yes. In those days, I was working 3 or 4 weeks ahead. And the problem was that the central news event, Watergate, was unrolling so rapidly. They were all kinds of wonderful stories that were breaking every day, and we would be overtaken by them. But the most significant one was a whole week of strips I'd done on Nixon's aide, John Ehrlichman. And Ehrlichman had resigned about a day after we had shipped a week on him. And this is back when it was in the mails. I mean, this wasn't just a question of pulling back an electronic file.
So in Doonesbury, he's still in office.
He's still in office. And that wasn't going to work. So we had to call them back in, put in a substitute week. That's when we said, okay, we can't be 3 weeks out. Let's try 2 weeks out. Let's try 1 week out.
Ehrlichman said he was sorry, didn't he?
Yeah, he sent me a letter of apology for his bad timing.
There's nothing that defines a journalist more than deadlines. We all know that if Dennis the Menace came a week or two or 30 years late, we wouldn't really notice. We would notice keenly if that happened with Doonesbury. And so I guess it made sense to everybody when the strip moved to so many editorial pages.
Made sense to everybody but the syndicate and myself, because we know how newspapers are read, and there's a great many more readers on the comics page than on the editorial page. So while it had some cachet to be on the editorial page or the op-ed page, in balance, it was a terrible idea. And we did a lot of jawboning. We really tried to talk editors out of it.
You know, Doonesbury has a very vibrant audience on Slate. It is still fundamentally a creature of the newspaper, and the newspaper, as we know, is in trouble. Are you going to be able to make some sort of seamless transition to pure digital distribution in the future? Do you anticipate that could happen?
It could happen. The open question is whether comic strip artists want to continue working in a revenue-free environment, mm-hmm. because nobody can make a living at it. There's one or two strips, webcomics, that are profitable because the merchandising associated with them is profitable. But just in terms of content, no one can make a living at it. And that may change. Somebody may figure out how to do that right. About 10 years ago, I partnered with an animation firm using a real-time motion capture technology that allowed us to build a wireframe of one of the characters, Duke. And it was 2000, so we ran him for president. And an actor in a motion capture suit would deliver his lines, and we placed him on a number of live news shows, Charlie Rose and the Today Show and a number of other shows.
You know why I'm running? I want to shake things up in Washington, Charlie. I want to be the ferret in the pants of government. I want to bring dignity back to the Oval Office, or failing that, good hygiene and a lot of disinfectant.
I thought it was a rather successful experiment, but it was, alas, a very expensive experiment. And like all the other web animation companies of that era, it went south quickly.
Sounds like something that could come around again and really soon.
I think so.
Was it Gerald Ford who, it was in, I think, in 1975, told the Radio and Television Correspondents Association that there are only three major vehicles to keep us informed as to what's going on in Washington: the electronic media, the print media, and Doonesbury, and not necessarily in that order?
It was wonderful. Ford was threatened by nothing. Everything rolled off him. All the Chevy Chase stuff that was done on Saturday Night Live, he enjoyed it all. He was somebody who was very comfortable in his own skin, as was Reagan. Reagan used to have an annual dinner for cartoonists. Reagan said he read every one of the cartoons in the Washington Post every day. Well, there were three pages of comic strips. So he spent a significant part of his presidency reading the comic.
I think so.
He just didn't take anything personally, and Ford was like that as well.
Well, let's talk about your depiction of presidents. Here, you seem to become more abstract than at any other time.
For years, I used an offstage voice. It was a voice coming up from the White House or out of a TV. And I'm actually back to that. But there was a period of time where I created icons as stand-ins for the presidents. And I'm, for the life of me, I can't remember how that occurred to me as a good idea. George Bush, of course, talked a great deal about the 1,000 points of light. And so he began life in the strip as a point of light.
George H.W. Bush.
Right. His vice president, Dan Quayle, because of the early perception of him as being lightweight, to say the least, was depicted as a feather. Newt Gingrich was depicted as a bomb about to explode. And our most recent president was a Roman centurion helmet.
George W. Bush.
Right. Hovering over an asterisk, which was a constant reminder of the results of the 2000 election.
And our current president is now an offstage voice again.
That's for probably two reasons. One, as I say, I just kind of got weary of the device. And the other is that no one was suggesting an icon that seemed to fit him. You know, he's a fairly nuanced guy, and he's problematic for satirists because he doesn't have salient features or temperament. You know, and I welcome any suggestions. The one that I've sort of taken with, I heard a couple of days ago, was a glass of water that's half full.
That's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad.
So what was the most surprising thing you learned looking back over 40 years of Doonesbury?
Well, I think that the strip, while it became fairly well known for its politics and for all the controversy, that the strip was ultimately a story of a generation coming of age. And then it became a story of another generation coming of age. And that's the great revelation of 40 years, is that, you know what, that's fun. And that's why the younger characters have really kind of replaced the older characters in the day-to-day narrative.
Mike Doonesbury's kid, Alex.
Right, she's become the center of the strip, and not through any sort of conscious process on my part. It just kind of evolved that way. I think it's because younger characters are caught up in becoming, and there's so many options. There's so many things they could be. And so they're just more dynamic. We know how Mike is going to react to any given dramatic situation. We don't know Alex. Alex is an unguided missile. She could take off in any direction. She's still trying to figure out who she's meant to be. And so those characters are just inherently more interesting to track.
Because they're not set in their ways. So as new situations come up, this set of characters gives you a lot more freedom.
Right.
Since the parade never ceases to pass by, do you think that you'll stop the strip?
I have a feeling that newspapers are going to perhaps make their exit before I would make that decision about myself. And I believe that I'm probably one of those strips that, really, a comic strip, once it's established, is the closest thing to tenure that a popular culture offers. And I think I'll be one of those guys turning out the lights.
Thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
Gary Trudeau is the creator of Doonesbury. Here's a little more of the animated Duke.
Some say each of these candidates, they are, in a sense, too connected to someone else. Well, here you are connected to Trudeau, and we know that he's a shadowy character because he doesn't make any appearances on television. But therefore, he's an American.
All right,
and
let me tell you something.
If he's an American, why are you associated with him?
Here's the deal. I am a lot less of a cartoon character than a lot of those other candidates out there. I am a product of my handlers, too, and I just think that if Gary Trudeau... I think that would sum it all up.
Yes, I think so, too.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Nerida Brownlee and edited by Brooke. To Bonnie Watt, thanks for all your help. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was John Delore.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and our grand vizier. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.